Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. Discovery Magazine has now joined the practice of publishing medical mysteries. I used to like reading the New York Times diagnosis column by Lisa Sanders, but those are now published jointly with video, a format that doesn't work very well for Sound Body. I also like the article Sandra Boodman writes for the Washington Post column Medical Mysteries, so I was happy to find a Discover Magazine special summer 2018 issue focusing on medical mysteries, because I love reading about the diagnostic detective work that saves lives, and I hope you're interested in it also. Going to start with Simple Sickness Gone Awry, written by Anna Reisman. When 43-year-old Barbara Harris found herself panting as she climbed the steps to her front door, she knew something was wrong. She was overweight and had high blood pressure, but she'd never been sick like this. In the hospital, she was shocked when her doctors told her she was suffering from mild congestive heart failure. Because her high blood pressure had gone untreated for years, her heart muscle had been damaged and was now unable to pump enough blood for her body's needs. Blood returning to the heart was backing up, resulting in fluid buildup in her lungs and making her short of breath. She also had a mild heart murmur, probably a remnant of a childhood bout with rheumatic fever. An echocardiogram, an ultrasound of the heart, confirmed that her mitral valve was slightly leaky, allowing blood back into the atrium and forcing her heart to work harder to pump it out. Harris was treated for 2 days and went home with medication to lower her blood pressure and decrease the buildup of fluid. 2 weeks later, on a cold February evening, she was back in the hospital. It was okay at first when I went home, she told us from her hospital bed. I was working that month on the inpatient wards as an attending physician, along with a resident and a medical student. Harris adjusted the prongs of the oxygen tubing in her nostrils. But it started again pretty quickly. I didn't even want to walk anymore. It got too hard. I'm out of breath, and my ankles are killing me. I pressed one of her ankles, leaving a little dent in the warm flesh, and asked her to rotate her feet. Wincing, she moved them a tiny bit. Ankle swelling could be a sign of heart failure, but mild cases do not usually cause pain. It was probably a red herring. Once a patient has congestive heart failure, treatment is a delicate balancing act that includes nuanced adjustment of medication, a low-salt diet, and frequent weight checks. In some people, this is easy. In others, missed medications or too much salt can cause the symptoms of uncontrolled congestive heart failure to return. But Harris had been avoiding salty food, and she hadn't missed any pills. She was so compliant, in fact, that her blood pressure and leaky heart valve probably could not explain the relapse at hand. It was time to rethink. We sat in the doctor's station and talked about what might have triggered her symptoms. A heart attack was a possibility. We could get better information from a stress test. Alcohol could do it, although Harris told us she didn't drink. So could a condition affecting the heart valves. She did have the heart murmur, but it was mild, or bacterial endocarditis, a potentially life-threatening infection of a valve. Over the next 2 days, we kept her busy. We cultured her blood for bacteria, which, if present, would increase the likelihood of bacterial endocarditis. We also sent her for various heart tests, but none of this told anything new. Her blood was clear of infection, and her heart was pumping well enough to rule out a heart attack. What had knocked it out of control? Look at this, Harris panted, pulling her sheet aside so we could see her legs. My ankles are fine now, but I'm hurting in my wrists. I can barely move my hands and my knees. Look how puffy. Dan, the resident, listened to her heart, his brow furrowed in concentration. Her heart sounds different, he said. Before, the lub-dub of her heart had been clear. Now, all I could hear were loud whooshing sounds. I was stunned. Dan and I were thinking the same thing. It had to be bacterial endocarditis. In endocarditis, small masses of bacteria form on the surface of a heart valve, and these little infected clumps, septic emboli, can slip off into the bloodstream. Depending on where they settle, they can cause major problems, abscesses, strokes, kidney disease, blood clots, and by interfering with the heart valve's normal function, congestive heart failure. I asked the student to draw some more blood to culture, again for bacteria, and to order another echocardiogram, which would show whether bacteria had built up on a valve. We were flabbergasted when the echocardiogram results came in that afternoon. It looked like another patient's heart, and a really bad heart at that. The mitral valve no longer leaked a small amount. Now a jet of blood regurgitated backward into the left atrium with each beat. And it wasn't only the mitral valve. The aortic valve also spewed blood in the wrong direction. The valves were damaged, but the echocardiogram showed no bacterial clumps. This didn't seem to be bacterial endocarditis. So why were her heart valves worsening before our very eyes? Dan wondered if we were missing a clue in her medical history. New murmurs, the ankle pain that went to her wrists and knees, congestive heart failure. Could she be having another bout of rheumatic fever? He asked. Because it had happened so many years earlier, we hadn't given much thought to her history of rheumatic fever, an inflammatory disease that can affect the heart, joints, and central nervous system. Interesting thought, I said to Dan, but something would have triggered it, and she said she'd been fine except for the congestive heart failure 2 weeks ago. That's true, Dan said, but what if she had something minor, like a sore throat, and didn't get treated for it? Rheumatic fever is a complication of something astonishingly basic, an untreated strep throat infection. When a particular type of strep bacterium, the group A beta hemolytic streptococcus, infects the throat and isn't treated promptly, it can trigger an autoimmune response, causing the body to turn on itself. One of the proteins on the strep bacterium's surface, the M protein, structurally resembles certain heart proteins. The body's natural response to a bacterial infection is to create antibodies to fight it. In the case of this particular streptococcus, the antibody to the M protein also works against the body's own heart proteins. The result? Autoimmune destruction of some heart tissue and the heart valves. Damage to those valves can lead to permanent and often serious rheumatic heart disease. The prevalence of rheumatic fever and rheumatic heart disease has plummeted in the past century in the United States and other industrialized countries, thanks to antibiotics and improved living conditions. In 1994, the last year the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tracked the incidence of acute rheumatic fever, there were just 112 cases in the country. Only a small number of sore throats in adults are caused by the strep bacterium that can, if untreated, trigger rheumatic fever. And most of us don't think about getting a culture every time we have a sore throat, since most are caused by viruses. But in people with a history of acute rheumatic fever, it's a different story. They are prone to significant risk from strep throat, especially if their original bout of rheumatic fever affected their heart. Dan and I had to go back to our patient for that missing piece of the puzzle. She stared out the window and thought back over the previous few months. At first, she couldn't recall being sick, but then she remembered. Back in January, she said, she'd had a sore throat and fever. I thought I had the flu, she said. It lasted a couple of days, and then I started to feel better. That was the clue we were looking for. We sent off one more test that might give us the answer, a blood test for an antibody signifying recent exposure to strep. The next day, the puzzle was solved. Harris had recurrent rheumatic fever. The original damage her mitral valve sustained as a result of her childhood rheumatic fever wasn't too serious. But the immune response to her strep throat in January had been dramatic, with a new wave of antibodies eventually wreaking havoc on her heart valves. It's a condition I had only read about and have never seen since. The response to treatment, at least for the joint pains, can be magical. Penicillin and high-dose aspirin erased Harris's discomfort in less than 24 hours. The damage to her valves, unfortunately, was permanent. although we could control her symptoms with diuretics and other medications, and although antibiotics stopped the strep bacteria's destructive barrage, we could not repair the heart itself. Because rheumatic fever is such an uncommon disease in the United States, nobody had educated Harris about the importance of promptly evaluating a sore throat. It simply wasn't something that most doctors, including me, thought about anymore. Our patient was better for now. We were finally treating the infection that was weakening her heart valves. If she hadn't been treated, she probably would have suffered additional valve damage and ended up with more advanced congestive heart failure. She might have needed more medication and perhaps surgery to replace the damaged valves. None of us would ever forget how dangerous an untreated strep throat infection could be, nor how a missing clue could so easily hide in plain sight. This is one of my favorites now. It's called The Man with the Mustache and is written by Louis Genera. It was my first day as an attending physician. Nervousness and excitement competed for the most prominent emotion inside me. I was assigned a medical ward full of patients, each an enigma, each a challenge. I introduced myself to the students, interns, and residents as I entered the conference room where we would begin hospital rounds. Jane, the senior medical resident, began her report on the toughest case on our service. Mr. Peterson is a previously healthy 61-year-old man who presented 2 weeks ago to his primary care physician complaining of protracted vomiting and diarrhea. All outpatient testing was normal. Jane paused to retrieve the patient's chart. Every test known to man was normal. There are always more tests, I said, smiling, so why is he in the hospital? Dehydration, said Jane. Every few hours he begins to throw up, then has massive diarrhea, and all for no apparent reason. Jane bit her lower lip. We really hope you can help us shed some light on this case. Does this poor guy have these symptoms all day and all night? I asked. No, it all quits when he's asleep. Intrigued, I held up my hand to receive the patient's chart. Slowly, I leafed through his test results. Jane's right, I thought, as I studied the results of the tests already obtained. Everything was normal. Blood work, liver and kidney function, radiologic tests, ultrasounds, CT scans, normal. Cultures from blood, urine, stool, unremarkable. There are no signs of infection. What did the GI consultants say? I asked Jane as I began to read the lengthy report from the gastrointestinal doctors who reviewed the case. GI is as perplexed as we are, said Jane. Scoping of the stomach and lower intestines shows nonspecific signs of inflammation with mild redness and swelling, but nothing diagnostic or even remotely helpful. Okay, I began, unsure of what to say, but desperately searching for something important to add. We've ruled out the usual. Now we need to think of the weird things. I smiled, remembering the words of the famous detective Sherlock Holmes. I declared with a deliberate professorial tone in my paraphrasing, "Once you've eliminated the usual causes, whatever is left, however improbable, must indeed be the correct diagnosis." "Like what?" asked Lauren, one of the medical students, obviously unimpressed by my words of wisdom. "Let's go see the patient first. Then let's research for unusual causes of symptoms," I said. "Jane, please lead the way to Mr. Peterson's room." As we proceeded down the hall, I silently reviewed the causes of diarrhea, not wanting to miss something by overlooking the obvious. Food poisoning occurs when one ingests foods that have toxins produced by infectious agents. But staph and E. coli were ruled out. My patient had not been traveling in an area where he might have contracted traveler's diarrhea, which can be due to infectious organisms such as Shigella, Salmonella, Giardia, or Campylobacter, among others. Tests for all these were negative. Pseudomembranous colitis? This is a condition caused by an overgrowth of a normal colonic bacteria, Clostridium difficile, typically after taking a course of antibiotics. I looked in the chart. Yep. It was ruled out already. What else? Viral gastroenteritis, an infection of the walls of the stomach and intestine, was ruled out. So was lactose intolerance. I probed deeper into my memory, trying to recollect the extremely unusual causes of our patient's symptoms. There are some exceptionally rare instances when vomiting and diarrhea can be caused by histamine or serotonin-producing tumors, the so-called carcinoid syndrome and mastocytomas. Produced in normal amounts, histamine and serotonin are crucial in the regulation of gut movement. But when the body produces too much, massive diarrhea can ensue. Syndromes like these are incredibly unusual. What are the chances that my first patient ever as a medical attending would have one of these? I took a deep breath as I re-entered my contemplative state. I see a few hours in the medical library in my near future relearning these conditions, I thought. We reached the patient's room. The first thing I noticed, you couldn't miss it, was the man's mustache, impressive and handsomely full. Even more striking than its bulk was how jet black his mustache was. The same went for his hair color. I sat down at his bedside and tried to ignore my mustache envy. I began explaining what I'm sure Mr. Peterson already knew and probably was tired of hearing over and over again. All the tests we've done so far have been negative. We still don't know why you continue to have vomiting and diarrhea. I was happy when Jane decided to chime in. We'll continue to study your case until we have something to go by. I noticed that as we spoke, the patient would occasionally run his tongue along his mustachio, left to right, then right to left, up and down. Then he would bite the hair. I tried to imagine what that must feel like, and then it occurred to me. Don't you worry, Mr. Peterson, Jane was saying. We'll figure you out yet, and how long have you had that mustache? I interrupted. Jane and the others looked at me like I just lost my mind. Almost a month, he said proudly, temporarily halting his mustache sucking and sweeping. And how is it that you keep it so black? I said. I'm amazed a man your age doesn't have some grays. Oh, I do. I use hair color. It looked like I wasn't going to spend overtime in the medical library after all. We need to see your hair color product, I said. I believe your vomiting and diarrhea are caused by your ingestion of the chemicals as you, I pointed at his tongue, which as I spoke, was making a pass through his thick upper lip hair. I believe if you shave your mustache, your vomiting and diarrhea will go away. As I explained, hair coloring involves the use of oxidation dyes, typically benzene and toluene-type chemicals. Over the years, concerns about the cancer-causing potential of these agents have been brought forth, but studies remain inconclusive. What is known is that these chemicals can be toxic. At the very least, they can cause skin irritation, a standard warning you'll find in the instructions of most hair coloring products. Certainly, they should never be ingested. Chronic intake of these chemicals may lead to serious health consequences such as liver and kidney toxicity and failure, and even death. In that light, my magnificently mustachioed patient was lucky that gastrointestinal symptoms were the worst of his problems. Thankfully, even those became a thing of the past for the patient. My hunch turned out to be correct. He shaved off the offending facial hair and remained free from his disabling symptoms ever more. And we go next to our last one for today, normal fatigue? Hardly. And this is written by H. Lee Kagan. It was the end of August when Thad returned from his Caribbean honeymoon, sporting a rich tan and a look of contentment. But as he sat in my exam room, he complained to me that he felt tired. Tired after a honeymoon, I said. Sounds about right. No, it's not that, he said with a smile. This is not like any kind of tired I've felt before. Healthy and fit his entire life, Thad was a young physician about to begin his orthopedic specialty training. I trusted him to be an accurate observer, and so I inquired about other possible symptoms he might have had. Then I examined him for evidence of conditions that can cause fatigue, like anemia. All was in order, I reassured him, but just to be certain, I drew some blood for screening tests. 2 days later, the lab reported that all the results were normal save one. Thad's level of thyroid hormone was low. Now his symptoms made sense. The thyroid gland, sitting low along the front of the throat, manufactures the hormone and releases it into the bloodstream, which carries it throughout the body to play a critical regulatory, mostly stimulatory role in almost all body functions. When there isn't enough of the hormone, things generally slow down, including metabolism. Weight may go up, mental activity may get sluggish, and fatigue may develop. Though not common in 20-somethings, hypothyroidism can occur at almost any age. In the United States, the most common reason for a drop in thyroid hormone production is autoimmune thyroiditis, an attack on the thyroid gland by the body's own defense mechanisms. Normally, our finely tuned immune system fends off only foreign material, like microbes, and leaves the body's own tissues alone. But for reasons that are not well understood, the immune cells will sometimes attack a normal organ, gradually destroying it and turning it into useless scar tissue. The treatment for chronic thyroiditis is to replace the missing hormone with pills taken daily. Thad was relieved that we had found an explanation for his persistent fatigue. He began taking the replacement thyroid hormone, confident that he would soon see his energy restored. He knew that thousands of people take thyroid hormone every day and live perfectly normal lives. But when I next heard from Thad, he told me that he was still tired. It had been 4 months since we last spoke. He said he'd been too busy since then to return for a check of his hormone levels. Could it be that the dose I'd prescribed for him was too low? I arranged for Thad to have a repeat blood test, which soon confirmed that his thyroid hormone blood levels were perfectly normal. The replacement dose was just right, but Thad wasn't. Something other than hypothyroidism was causing him to feel unwell. Fatigue is a singularly nonspecific symptom. The list of possible causes is one of the longest in all of medicine, ranging from malignancies, infected heart valves, and anemia, to just plain lack of sleep. Consequently, when a patient's sole complaint is tiredness, the underlying cause can be elusive. In dealing with such a case, I often repeat to myself what I've told my medical students countless times over the years. When the history points nowhere, you have to look everywhere. Thad's history and physical exam would need to be revisited with a fresh eye. I called and asked him to return to the office for another evaluation. At the follow-up visit, it was immediately apparent that Thad had lost weight. Not even his tan could hide the fact that something was amiss. A glance at the vital signs in the chart confirmed that this previously healthy young man had dropped nearly 10 pounds in 4 months. My level of concern rose. I began working my way through a long list of questions. Though it is tedious and time-consuming, the systematic review of symptoms is a staple of the diagnostician's armamentarium that more often than not yields important clues. Yet, this time, nothing new emerged, apart from the fact that Thad had lost not only his energy and some weight, but also his appetite. I sat back and looked at my patient, mentally searching myriad diagnoses for ones that fit this clinical picture. It was then that I finally saw it, saw what I've been staring at all along. Sitting across from me was a man who, 4 months after returning from the Caribbean, was as bronzed as the day he'd come home. And no, I quickly ascertained, he had not been visiting a tanning center. Appetite, weight, energy, all were diminished. The one thing my patient had not lost was his tan. Why? Apart from his pigmentation, Thad's only other noteworthy physical finding was a low normal blood pressure. When I asked him to rise from a lying to a standing position, his blood pressure fell to a seriously low level, low enough to cause lightheadedness and even fainting in most people. But Thad said he felt none of this. He's young and fit, I told myself, and the problem has come on gradually. His system's been able to adapt. But what was the problem? By now, I was reasonably sure that I had enough pieces to put the puzzle together. Fatigue, hypotension, low blood pressure, with postural changes, loss of appetite with accompanying weight loss, and hyperpigmentation all fit with a diagnosis of Addison's disease, a disorder of the adrenal glands that results in lack of cortisol, a vital hormone produced by the gland's outer layer. It is one of the body's steroid hormones, essential to mounting the fight-or-flight response to serious stress or trauma, as well as the day-to-day regulation of numerous physiological functions. When the body senses that the paired adrenal glands, one lying atop each kidney, are failing to produce sufficient cortisol, the brain sends a chemical signal to prompt the glands to make more. Oddly enough, that same signal also triggers special cells in the skin to generate more melanin, or skin pigment, causing hyperpigmentation. The coloration can look just like a tan, albeit one that darkens the skin body-wide, even the palms and armpits. My patient's honeymoon tan had transformed into the classic pigmentation of Addison's disease. New blood tests confirmed that Thad's cortisol levels were quite low. They also revealed disturbances of his body's electrolyte or mineral concentrations and water regulation. These two are part of the Addisonian picture, a result of low levels of another adrenal hormone called aldosterone. I immediately prescribed replacement steroids for Thad to take. Confirmatory tests would have to be done, but it was imperative that replacement steroids be started right away. Left untreated, adrenal insufficiency can lead to an Addisonian crisis, a serious and sometimes fatal condition brought on by emotional or physical stress. It is not for nothing that cortisol is often called the stress hormone. In the developing world, infections like tuberculosis are the leading cause of adrenal insufficiency. But in the United States, Addison's most commonly results from an autoimmune disorder. Autoimmunity. There it was again, looking at the bigger picture, I saw that Thad had now sustained two separate glandular failures due to immune malfunction, his thyroid and his adrenals. In fact, he was manifesting the features of a rare disorder known as Schmidt's syndrome, a type of malfunction of the immune system called autoimmune polyglandular syndrome, or APS. It is not only the thyroid and adrenal glands that are at risk in APS. The syndrome can affect the pancreas, which produces insulin, the lack of which is found in diabetes, and the testes and ovaries, which produce the hormones necessary for normal sexual development and function. No one knows the underlying cause of this disorder or why it has a predilection for endocrine tissue, and no one knows how to shut off the process once it starts. And we need to leave it there with one paragraph left of today's Discover Magazine Summer 2018 issue, Medical Mysteries. Thank you for tuning in. Stay well and come back next week to Sound Body for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, WXXI.org.